A thing that looks like a police box standing in a junkyard. It can move anywhere.
Haven, concentrate on Sin. Give priority to the detectors and the navigation systems.
There is a corridor. And the corridor is time. It surrounds all things.
On display, I eventually had to go down to the cellar. That's the display department. With a torch. The lights are probably gone. So had the stairs.
You are just number 6.
I am not a number. I am a person.
Welcome to British Invaders, episode 25. This is the podcast all about British science fiction television, and today we are talking about Gormenghast. This is Brian from Canada.
And this is Eamon from England. Hello.
Gormenghast is a strange type of castle that is so large that it's even almost a city-state in and of itself. And our story begins where the heir to the Groan family, the throne of the Earl of Gormenghast, is born. At roughly the same time as Titus Groan is born, Steerpike, a lowly kitchen boy, starts his rise to power through any influence he can manage to use.
So Gormenghast is a BBC adaptation. It was a miniseries that came out just after Christmas in 2000, I believe. And it was an adaptation by the BBC of the books by Mervyn Peake. The books from the Gormenghast series, there's 3 books, and this is an adaptation of the first 2 books in the series, which were Titus Groan and the second book, Gormenghast, which obviously they've used as the title of the series here. They're hugely popular, these books. There's a big following for Mervyn Peake, as we'll talk about in a while. So the BBC produced this quite interesting miniseries.
This is definitely a case of an adaptation of a classic series of novels being brought to the screen.
Yeah, absolutely.
It was a BBC production. It was actually a co-production, with the hands-on production being done by the BBC and WGBH, PBS from Boston.
Yet again.
Definitely again. They were involved as significant co-producer here, I believe mainly contributing funds. But WGBH has a long tradition of working with the BBC and showing and supporting British programming. In particular, they aired a series for many years. It may still be on. It was called Mystery. It showed various British mystery and detective series, including Poirot and the Jeremy Brett Sherlock Holmes series and Campion with Peter Davison and many others. They did a lot of those, and WGBH was doing that series.
Right.
And the more minor co-producer sneaking in there was Chum Media from Canada. They have a sci-fi cable channel called Space the Imagination Station that runs here in Canada. It had just been around for a few years at this point, in 2000, 2001, and they aired it and were listed as a minor co-producer as well.
So we got this BBC production with assistance from Boston and Canada, and we've got a BBC production team. I think it was the idea of a chap called Andy Wilson, who was the director of this miniseries. And I think he'd always wanted to do Gormenghast after he'd read the books when he was a student. And he worked with a producer called Estelle Daniel. They had a screenwriter called Malcolm Mackay, who adapted the first 2 novels into this 4-part miniseries, which the BBC did. To do so, they had to come up with quite a bit of design to get the look of it right.
And this was where Christopher Hobbs came into things. He did the set designs and the production design and gave it a very unique look. Lots of color, lots of things that looked bright and new and yet at the same time old and decaying. It was a very nice sort of look to it. And the type of model work he used for views of the castle slash city from afar lent it a very unusual and dynamic look to it that was somewhere between looking at a very large scale model and looking at almost watercolor or something that isn't quite real, and that worked very well.
Yeah, I mean, we'll talk about more about it, but it certainly had a fantastic and a very distinctive look, this series.
Yes, it is very distinctive for sure. It was released, as you said, in 4 one-hour episodes in the UK. It was actually aired, I believe, in 2 parts, at least here in Canada on Space the Imagination Station, and I think in Boston as well. And I believe it must have been edited down because I'm pretty sure we didn't have a full 4 hours of content, which is what you did have in the British episodes and on the DVDs.
Well, we should talk about some of the content. We'll get on with the story and with the characters in particular, because there's certainly a lot of characters to talk about in the Gormenghast novels and in this adaptation. We'll start with the very memorable Groan family itself, who are the sort of nobility, the royal family of Gormenghast. Some of the characters we first meet are the lord of the family. That's Lord Sepulgrave Groan, who is the 76th Earl of Gormenghast, who's a rather elderly lord. He's a rather sad and melancholic figure who's mainly interested in his books and his histories and his poets that he reads. And he was played by a fantastic British television actor called Ian Richardson, who's just had an enormously successful career and who sadly, since this series was made, has passed away in the last few years, unfortunately. He's very good in the role. And his wife, the lady, or the sort of matriarch of the Groan family, Lady Gertrude, a rather monstrously obese lady with lots of red hair, played by Celia Imrie, and she's a great character as well. If Lord Groan is more interested in his books than people, then Lady Gertrude is more interested in her birds and cats than the people of her family and the castle. And so we see lots of scenes of her surrounded by her animals.
The two of them really made a great couple. It was this combination of the sort of somber ruler who is very introspective and he is very occupied with the formalities and the ritual of ruling Gormenghast. And then you have Gertrude, who is this abrasive, witch-like woman who is very bizarre and set apart from everyone else and complaining and always criticizing everyone. She's a real stereotype of the controlling matriarch, but it's one that was handled very well and fits into the story well enough that it doesn't feel like a cliche or a stereotype.
No, they're very good. It's a very odd couple, but they're fantastic.
And then you get to Lady Fuchsia, their daughter. I guess she's in her upper teens at the beginning of the story.
Yeah, she's pretty young to begin with, isn't she? Yeah.
And she is basically completely self-absorbed. Everything she can want is provided for her, but because she's a woman, she's not an heir to the kingdom, and she has basically no responsibilities. And she's this self-absorbed young person who is very talkative and effervescent and completely at the center of her own world.
And she's interested in sort of stories, and it's strange because she wants to be a fairy tale princess living in a castle, which is a bit strange in a way because she almost is a fairy tale princess living in a castle.
That's right.
But she's interested in stories and acting and theatre and drama. And I think as we see later on in the story as it progresses, she has these fantasies about living in a fairy tale life. But when she actually gets the actuality, she doesn't really want that. She prefers the fantasy, I think.
That's right. Which gives you our first hints at what Mervyn Peake was doing with the idea of this sort of dark fairy tale where it's almost like a fairy tale, but then it's not a fairy tale. And then we have Clarice and Cora, who are two twin sisters. They were the sisters of Sepulgrave the Earl. And the two of them are referred to as the silly sisters or the stupid sisters. And they clearly do not have much in the way of smarts at all. They are pretty dense. They're obsessed with the idea that they used to have some power and all of the power has gone to their brother. They are easily manipulated and tend to be manipulated, and they are very fun to watch. They are sort of used as comic elements, but they're comic in a way that it really works. And in a way that there's an element of sadness to it as well. They're taken advantage of and left in poor situations because of it.
Yeah, I mean, it is. They are quite tragic characters, but they also, as you say, they're terribly entertaining characters whenever they're on screen because they're identical. And not only are they identical, they basically have simultaneous speech and mannerisms. So the two actresses playing them do everything exactly at the same time and speak together, which is quite remarkable.
Yes, they did a great job of doing that. That was Zoe Wanamaker and Lindsay Baxter, who are about 15 years separated in age, but because of the makeup that was involved, they brought off being identical twins quite well. And their mannerisms and speech and how they went from being in perfectly locked unison to bouncing back from one to the other was done very well.
It's absolutely fantastic. I mean, as you say, they are, the actresses resemble them each other slightly, but with makeup, they look identical in this series. And then their mannerisms and speech is just fantastic. Then we have another groan. We have the title character of the first book, Titus himself, the 77th Earl, whose birth we sort of witness at the very start of the miniseries. Obviously, we first meet him as a baby, and then later on in the series, we'll meet him played by two older actors, Cameron Parry, who plays Titus aged about 12, I think, and Andrew Robinson, who plays him when he's about 17, I think. There's some couple of striking things about the character of Titus. Firstly is his physical appearance. He has very striking, I think they're referred to as violet eyes. So he looks very striking. And then the other interesting thing about Titus is that he's born into this terribly sort of noble and privileged family. But as he grows up, he will, to a certain extent, he will rebel against that. And he will not want the privilege and also the responsibilities that go with that.
He's one of the few groans in the family groan who actually has a mind of his own. You know, a lot of them there are pretty set on going in a straight line and are not too bright. I think they're references to the idea of maybe inbreeding and that kind of thing. But he has a mind of his own, which sets him apart from Fuchsia and Clarice and Cora, and to a point even from his father, Lord Groan.
Absolutely, yes. I mean, as you say, he's the one who thinks for himself. We do have this strange setup in Gormenghast. You know, we have this terribly noble family, and there's a character, Titus, who almost wants to get out of that noble family, and then there's another character who perhaps wants something different.
That's right. There are certainly lots of things going on here. Titus was a character that was very well handled. It's interesting because in the books of Gormenghast, he is, I believe, 1 year old at the end of the first book. At the end of the second episode of the TV miniseries we're talking about, again, he was 1 year old. So you have this half of the story being told while you basically have a baby as the title character of the first book and as the central character or one of the central characters of the story. We had a total of, I think, 4 actors playing Titus Groan, including the baby.
Yeah, I think we've got a baby, a toddler, a 12-year-old, and then an older teenager.
That's right. Even with the baby, and certainly the toddler, the way he's played with the eyes are done very well. They give him these blue-violet, very vivid kind of eyes, and when he is first born, he is seen as being incredibly ugly. And we also have a whole series of characters who are in the court and are involved with the groans, but are not among the nobility themselves. In particular, we have Steerpike. And Steerpike, at the beginning of the series, is a kitchen boy who basically, in this class as being a kitchen boy, never leaves the lower levels of the castle. He's always in and around the kitchens, which are portrayed basically as a kind of hell with the hot ovens. He is basically condemned to always be there. But Steerpike is intelligent and manipulative and maniacal, a sort of Machiavellian character who takes every opportunity he can to get attached to other people and move to different roles and move from one place to another to accumulate power. And rising up from the low levels to the high levels is something that does not happen in the society of Gormenghast. And it's only through these very immoral means that Steerpike is able to do that. Steerpike was played by Jonathan Rhys-Meyers, a very young Jonathan Rhys-Meyers. He was about 23 at the time. This was before he was starring in The Tudors and the Elvis miniseries, and before he was in Vanity Fair. He was in this. It was the first time I had come across him. And his performance is definitely one to watch. It's quite something.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, he's, as you say, Steerpike is this incredibly manipulative character who will do anything to rise to power. Rhys-Meyers' performance is very dramatic. It's quite theatrical. It's very interesting to watch. Steerpike is the character. If Titus doesn't really want the privilege that he's been born into, Steerpike really does. Steerpike wants to be on the inside of the nobility and the privilege.
The character has some resemblance reference to Shakespeare's version of Richard III, of the character who is locked out of where he wants to be and will kill and manipulate and do whatever he has to do to rise up to where he wants to be.
And then we've got other members of the court at Gormenghast. We've got, as you've probably gathered, if you're not familiar with Gormenghast, Mervyn Peake's character names are fantastic. So we get to the Lord Sepulgrave's servant, who's a character called Flay, who is in the books and in the series is a tall, slim, angular, stiff, elderly servant who is absolutely fanatically loyal to Gormenghast and to Lord Groan in particular. So to play this tall, angular, stiff character, they had Christopher Lee himself in this miniseries, and actually been fantastic throughout the miniseries. And I think you'd noted, Brian, that Christopher Lee has like a record number of film roles and television roles over the years. He has some astonishing amount of performances.
He has claimed that he has more film credits as an actor than anyone else. I don't know if anyone has authenticated that or not, but he has appeared in an enormous number of films, ranging from the old Dracula and Frankenstein films up through the recent Star Wars prequels and Lord of the Rings. He played the character, I think faithfully to the book, as someone who speaks very little and rarely says a full sentence. He speaks enough, but very economically, and will say a few words at a time and rarely more than that.
Yes, absolutely.
And Christopher Lee was able to do that and at the same time bring a very strong sense of character to this role. It was very good. And we had another servant, in addition to Flay being the chief servant for Lord Groan, we had Swelter, who was the head of the kitchen staff. And the story basically starts with Swelter hammering down on Steerpike and Flay coming in to essentially rescue Steerpike. Not because Flay cares anything for Steerpike, but because Flay and Swelter have this enormous rivalry going on. And Flay believes that the kitchen staff are below him in class, which fits with the rest of how things are portrayed. And Swelter is just maniacal and just hates Flay, and the two of them are going back and forth at each other, and Steerpike became a sort of pawn in their game and was aided by Flay just because of that. But Swelter was this large and sort of rude and unwieldy cook or chef type character who was consistently rather unpleasant, and played by Richard Griffiths, who has also done a lot of work over the years. And apparently he was actually considered to star in Doctor Who in 1963 when it first started.
Yeah, right. I didn't know that. Instead of William Hartnell.
That's right.
I mean, as you say, great names again, Swelter and Flay, and their hatred of each other, which I don't think is ever explained in the books or in the series, but they just absolutely hate each other, don't they?
There's an obvious unpleasant history between them.
Yeah. And we'll mention a couple of the other characters. I mean, there's two numerous to mention, really, but we'll have two more. Dr. Prunesqualler and his sister Irma. And if the Groans represent the upper class of Gormenghast, and Steerpike, Flay and Swelter sort of represent the below stairs, lower classes, well then I guess in the middle class we have Prunesqualler and Irma. Prunesqualler is the doctor who attends the Groan family, but to a certain extent he and his sister are also part of their social circle and are invited to some of the social and traditional and ritual events that we come across in Gormenghast. Dr. Prunesqualler is played by John Sessions, a great Renaissance man of British television, an actor and comedian, quite a well-known intellect. And then his sister Irma, who's a very strange character, very sort of, and again, a very tall, thin character who is convinced of her own good looks, but is actually rather strange looking. And again, almost played for comic relief. And she was played by Fiona Shaw, another very famous Shakespearean actor who's perhaps probably better known now for playing Mrs. Dursley in the Harry Potter films, where she is in the films married to Richard Griffiths, Swelter.
An interesting combination. Dr. Prunesqualler is played as a sort of advisor to the Groans and particularly to Gertrude. He brings some intelligence to things because he is something of a fool and played as a fool, but is actually quite a smart guy. And Lady Gertrude is one of the few people who recognizes that.
And he figures stuff out as we go along, doesn't he?
Is it justice that he has taken everything that is yours? Do you believe this injustice should be destroyed? So then how do you destroy your brother? How has he done this to you? Why is he so clever?
He reads it all in books.
Exactly. If he didn't have his books, he wouldn't be so clever, would he? If he wasn't so clever, you could defeat him, couldn't you? What's the best way to destroy books?
I would burn them. So would I. With fire.
Books are in the library.
Oh, well, we oughtn't to burn the library.
Oh, no.
Lady Clarice. Lady Cora. I told you I come in serious errand. Listen to this. At the end of next week, his lordship, your brother, is holding a gathering for the family to discuss a breakfast for Titus.
A gathering for the family?
Oh, we can wear purple.
No, the green.
Purple.
Green. Purple. Green.
You're not invited. Even Prune Squalor and his silly sister have been invited. But not Lady Clarice. And not Lady Cora.
Not invited?
Lady Clarice.
Lady Cora.
Not invited?
Not invited. Personally, I think your plan to burn down the library is genius.
We want to do it.
So do I. Burn it, burn it.
The story, as we said, starts with the birth of Titus Groan, who already at birth is being referred to as the 77th Earl. Lord Groan is the Earl, and he's the 76th Earl. And this family has actually been in power in this castle for 76 and going into 77 generations. So there is a kind of rot or decay that you see in the society and the castle. And at the same time, as we start our story, we have the top of the class system and the bottom of the class system. We have Steerpike being introduced and manipulating his way to greater position as he can. But Steerpike being introduced to us in a way where he's being beaten down upon by Swelter and then going off with Flay to try to get more influence through Flay.
He's going to rise to power. He's going to sort of like overcome his very humble origins and rise to power. And he's going to do it by very sort of devious means. He's going to lie and he's going to manipulate and he's going to flatter people. And he's even going to murder if that's what it takes to get his way to power. So he starts out by flattering Lady Fuchsia and really coming to her attention and impressing her with his drama and his storytelling and his acting. I think she gets him a job with the Prune Squalors, and he's set then on the rise on the ladder to power in a way from there. And he's, you know, his rise to power is going to bring him into conflict with the Groan family and with the traditions of Gormenghast itself.
That's right. He sets himself up as Fuchsia's clown, essentially. He even refers to himself as her clown and works to be a different kind of servant. He can never be in the ruling class. He always has to be a servant. But he keeps moving to things that give him more influence. And never actually comes face-to-face to fight someone or murder someone face-to-face with his own hands, but is always very devious and puts people up against each other and uses poison and uses this very convoluted sequence of things that sort of hides him in what is going on. He is incredibly manipulative the whole way through.
It's great stuff to watch it. Steerpike and Rhys Meyers' performance and his sort of rise through the ranks. And there's a very revealing comment at one point, I think, when Dr. Prune Squalor comments about Steerpike and says something like he climbs faster than ivy. That tells us a bit about Steerpike, and it also tells us a little bit about the doctor, who is, as we've already said, is actually watching what's going on and is perhaps cleverer than he at first appears.
That's right. It sets up something where you have Steerpike as the agent of change, albeit in this very devious type of way, but he is clearly working more change than has been seen in Gormenghast Castle, at least in the upper levels of Gormenghast Castle, for many years.
And one of the things they don't like at Gormenghast is change. Gormenghast is built on tradition and ritual. They even have a character called Barkentine in the miniseries, although I know it's two different characters in the books. his job is just to control all the rituals and traditions that go on in the day-to-day running of Gormenghast, even down to the colour of eggs that Lord Sepulchrave can have for his breakfast. It depends on what the book says for that particular day. So there is a very much, as you say, there's themes going on in Gormenghast, and one of the themes is this stuff about tradition and about breaking traditions and about Titus rebelling against tradition.
Yes, there's this idea of tradition on one side and then Titus trying to break out of these traditions to seek his freedom. So it's like this tradition versus freedom. Steerpike trying to go, again, against tradition, but manipulating and using the tradition. So for him, it's like oppression versus freedom, or oppression versus the tradition, which is maybe not freedom, but at least it's better than the very oppressive life of the kitchen boy that he had to begin with. Another thing that comes up with that is there are these strong themes, as we've mentioned, of the class system and the lower class versus the upper class and the ruling class and so on. It gives you the feeling that a little bit of this world of Gormenghast is like a satire or a parody of the sort of Victorian English class system or something like it. And I think the world of Gormenghast is much more than that. There's much more detail and much more going on than merely being a parody or a satire. But there are some elements of that that you get that feeling that that's what some of it is about, as being a bigger and more intense version of it.
Oh, absolutely, yes. I mean, I think, as you say, Mervyn Peake was including some of that in his books about class struggles in the early part of the 20th century. So, yeah, there's a lot going on about the classes in here as well. So we should talk a bit more about the look and the sounds and the feel of the production, which we've already mentioned has been very distinctive. I think one of the advantages the production team had when they came to adapt Gormenghast was that Mervyn Peake himself was an artist. And if you've read the books, you'll know that they contain several of Peake's own sketches of some of the characters. So I think they did have his drawings and artwork to influence them. But I think they made a deliberate decision to slightly brighten the look of the production, because Peake's illustrations are very dark and brooding and gothic, and they went for a slightly more, I don't know, almost, as you say, almost a fairy tale appearance. And they took influences from sort of Chinese and Eastern cultures to give it this very dramatic, distinctive look to the castle and the surrounding lands of Gormenghast.
It's definitely a blend of styles, and I thought that worked very well. You have elements of this sort of dark, colorless, gothic kind of style with lots of decay and big arching rooms and things like this. And then at the same time, you have these brightly colored patterns in amongst it, and these Asian and Eastern types of designs and carvings and things fitting in with it. Those balanced out and gave you this sort of surreal feel to it that was really quite good.
Yeah. Absolutely, very impressive. And they had to, I think, develop new techniques to actually produce some of the sets and production stuff.
That's right. They did some interesting things. Christopher Hobbs had this technique that he had used before but was not in wide use, which was that he built the models of Gormenghast, which were in part based on these Asian and fairy tale and brightly colored kinds of things, and in part on the more gothic things with influences from Mervyn Peake's own work. He built these models of it, but submerged the models underwater and added some sorts of chemicals to the water, and I'm not sure what they were. The models were then shot on camera from outside the tank through the glass of the water tank, so you see these models actually underwater, but they are not visibly or clearly underwater. It just gives them a kind of weight or mass, and at the same time plays with the dimension and the shape of things, which I think definitely adds to the surreal look of it. You certainly can't tell that they're underwater. I wouldn't have known that.
No, I didn't know that at all. And to be honest, I didn't even really spot them as models. They just look fantastic. It's quite difficult to describe the effect he achieves, but I mean, I've not seen anything like it before or since.
It's quite surreal. It doesn't look like anything that is real, but it doesn't look like any of the other things we're used to seeing either.
In model work, no.
That's right. It feels a bit, or in matte paintings for that matter, it feels a bit like you're looking at watercolor, you know, at a watercolor painting.
Yeah,
but
absolutely.
It's much more three-dimensional, but the dimension, it feels very different.
Yeah, it's absolutely remarkable. And as you say, I think 3D watercolor is a good description. And it's certainly, if you've not seen this miniseries, it's worth checking it out almost just for these shots, because they're remarkable. As is the costume and makeup work for the characters. I mean, as we've said, we've got these fantastic characters, fantastic names, and then they all have remarkable costumes and makeup. I mean, I think over the years, you know, the BBC gets criticised for a lot of things to do with science fiction and fantasy, with some not being able to do the sets and the special effects terribly well. But I think, you know, even going back to early Doctor Who and things like Marco Polo, you can never criticise the BBC for costumes, because they're always fantastic. And this is no exception. They're really quite remarkable, aren't they?
Yes, the BBC particularly does historical costumes very well. They really went to the next level with this. They had things with a historical look to them, but they designed patterns for the cloth based on each character. They designed the crest of Gormenghast that shows up in set design and in costumes. It really does look very good.
It's great. And I mean, and also the makeup as well. The makeup we've already mentioned for Clarys and Cora and for Lady Gertrude. And it's just fantastic. You know, we've got three actresses, Celia Imrie, Zoe Wanamaker and Lindsay Baxter, who are all very attractive women. And they're almost unrecognizable with the makeup artist's work on them.
Yes, they did a great job with character in this. The way that each character is dressed and shot and portrayed, you end up with these very extreme characters that are almost caricatures because they're so extreme, and yet they're so detailed that they aren't caricatures, which is very nice. And it all comes together. And you have characters like Barkentine with a beard that moves around as he talks, and this very sort of stuffy pulled down clothing that fits the stuffy character, and so on and so forth.
Yeah. And there was one particular feature of the production was Lady Gertrude's white bird, who she calls Master Chalk. As we've said, she has a room full of birds and cats, but her particular favourite that she talks through to throughout the series is Master Chalk, who, I have to confess, it's a while since I read the books, and I cannot remember if he appears in the books or was just for the series.
He does appear in the book, and in both cases, in the book and in the TV series, Master Chalk is a white rook, a rook being a bird related to a crow.
And they had to find one for the production.
Which is a challenge, because white rooks...
There aren't that many of them.
They basically don't exist. Rooks are black. They're like crows. While they were researching production, they looked into doing an animatronic white rook, and it was basically beyond their budget.
That's right.
Yeah, they weren't sure what they could do with this. It was this big deal until the director happened to be reading a newspaper he wouldn't normally read and read about an albino white rook chick that fell out of a tree somewhere. And they then made arrangements to have this white rook trained from being a chick to be used for film. And they had, I believe at the time, the only known living white rook playing a white rook.
There you go. Absolutely fortuitous. And a remarkable performance.
Master Chalk was one of my favorite characters. Master Chalk was great in this.
Yeah.
It's a very unnerving sort of bird, because it's a completely stark white bird that does not look like a white bird. It looks like a crow almost. It looks like a bird of prey, and yet it's pure white.
And he features in the title sequence with the music, doesn't he? We actually see him right at the start of each episode.
Certainly does. Which brings us into the music that was used in Gormenghast. There was an incidental music score written by Sir Richard Rodney Bennett, and it was quite good. It set the scene very well and worked quite well in this series. But then what added to things and brought things even a level up further was the choral music that was written by Sir John Taverner. And Sir John Taverner is quite a well-known concert composer, especially for his choral music. And the choral music that he wrote for this, with a mixed choir and a treble young boy soloist really set the tone of the type of tradition they have and the formalities. Almost any time formality and ritual and ceremony was involved in Gormenghast, which was quite frequent, Sir John Taverner's music would become part of it. And it also sets the tone in the opening title sequence of each episode. I thought the choral music in this worked very well, and it really added to what you had in this series.
Yeah, it's great. And, you know, the BBC have been getting some great musical input into some of these series we've talked about on British Invaders. And here we've got two musical knights for you, Brian. Two sirs.
Yeah, and Sir John Taverner is absolutely the perfect person to use for something like this when it comes to choral music, I would say. And just for obscurity, I have to throw in the note that some of you may be thinking, wasn't John Taverner a composer from the 16th or 17th century? Well, he was, and that was John Taverner, and this is John Taverner. John Taverner being a direct descendant of John Taverner. So there has been music, and in fact, choral music in that family for quite some time.
I'm sure regular British Invaders listeners will have realized that one of Brian's other specialist interests, apart from British science fiction television, is choral music and composers.
Well, yes, I have to admit to that one.
Your Lordship, as the 76th Earl of Grome, it is written that you shall now accompany your son there to the Iron Bowl of Moatwater.
Right. Well, I guess that will probably wrap up our first part of our discussion about Gormenghast. In the next episode, we'll continue our discussion as the story moves along towards a very dramatic conclusion, but there will be some comic relief along the way. We're also going to be talking a bit more about Mervyn Peake himself, and we'll also be giving our recommendations on this series, which might be interesting because in the last couple of shows we've covered, we've sort of gone 50-50, so you'll see whether or not we might agree on this one.
That's right. And the life and work of Mervyn Peake is quite interesting, so that should be a neat one to talk about that when we get to it. So, you can reach us at BritishInvaders@gmail.com, and you can find us at www.BritishInvaders.com. So, goodbye for now, and this is Brian from Canada, signing off.
And it's goodbye from Eamon in England as well.